Mr. Colhane, if you would address whether Amicus is going to share any time with you, that would be helpful, too.
Yes, Your Honor. The Amicus will not be sharing time with me, but counsel for Amicus Curiae, Karen Brody, is at counsel table with me, as is my client, Darren Sparrow, both in his individual capacity and as president of Zeke Coffee, Inc., which I will refer to as Perkill. May I please the court? My name is Daniel Colhane, registration number 22196, and I represent the plaintiff's appellants, Zeke Coffee, Inc., DBA Perkill Coffee, and Darren Sparrow. I would like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal, and Your Honor, if you'd be so kind as to wave at me in about 12 minutes, that would be very helpful.
I'll throw something at you or something.
Thank you. This is a case that has significant implications for Colorado law because the district court invented a new standard for evictions, which, if upheld, would render Colorado's FED statute essentially moot and would reverse decades of landlord-tenant law. Practitioners in the judiciary in Colorado have long used Colorado's FED statute as a checklist. A court typically goes through the statute one section at a time, and if the landlord cannot demonstrate compliance with each section, then the judge summarily rejects the eviction action and dismisses it and requires the landlord to start the proceedings all over again. As Justice Lohr noted in his dissent in Franken Building Company versus Fail, this is the balance created by the FED statute. If the landlord strictly complies with the statute, then the landlord may quickly recover possession of the leased premises from the defaulting tenant. However, the tenant's rights are protected by the requirement of strict adherence to the statutory requirements. The Colorado Supreme Court affirmed these principles in 2009 in Miles versus Fleming. If the landlord cannot demonstrate compliance with each and every part of the statute, then the eviction action is dismissed. But in the case before the court, instead of applying the statute, the district court created and applied a new standard where a landlord may invoke the benefits of the statute by demonstrating that an alleged event of default that could have been cured but was not continues to exist at trial. Under the trial court's new standard, a tenant is no longer entitled to several important rights adopted by the General Assembly to ensure that leases are not forfeited without due process of law. These rights include the rights A, to receive personal service of notice, B, informing the tenant of the nature of the alleged breach, C, providing a statutory 3-day cure period, D, personal service of a summons with specific language, and E, a complaint that alleges landlord's compliance with the procedural and substantive rights provided in the statute.
Mr. Colhane, can I interrupt you here for a second?
Yes, sir. Well,
I have just a preliminary question. Nobody here argues anything about mootness. I presume there's no dispute about mootness because there's at least an attorney fee issue in this case, depending how the FED issue gets resolved. Am I right about that?
Well, Your Honor, if I understand your question, there is an attorney fee issue that's here. We do not believe the case is moot. I was referring to the statute being rendered moot by...
No, I understand that. But on the FED action, I mean, your client has been out of the premises for a long time at this point.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, is there any issue? Is the premises re-let?
Yes, the premises is re-let, and we know that the tenant is not going back in there. But we're asking the court to enter judgment in favor of the tenant and permit the tenant to pursue a claim for damages for its lost leasehold.
That was what I was asking. So now let me ask you on the requirements that you were just pointing out.
Yes,
you mentioned notice and all that. I have some interest in this question. You say you have to have served a separate complaint and you had to have personally served. Why couldn't this be done, an FED action be brought by a counterclaim?
Well, Your Honor, I think a couple of reasons. First of all, the statute says so. The statute says a complaint. The statute refers to the landlord as the plaintiff. the tenant as the defendant, and that's consistent throughout.
We talk about counterclaim plaintiffs as well, and the vernacular, I suppose, lawyers sometimes talk about a counterclaim as a complaint. I'm just a little concerned that elevates form over substance to say you have to file a separate complaint.
And Your Honor, perhaps there are a couple of the statutory requirements that may lend themselves to a little bit of leeway. However, some of the statutory requirements, such as the statutory right to cure default, the person in service, those things, those are substantive rights, and rules of court really shouldn't be deemed to trump substantive rights. And Your Honor, I refer you to the case of Borer versus Lewis, which is cited in the brief, which stands for that principle. And the district court reached a truly bizarre result in this case. It ended up evicting a tenant who always paid its rent at the behest of a landlord who failed to comply with the statutory requirements. And after permitting the landlord to accept tens of thousands of dollars of rent and other benefits from tenant, even after the alleged breaches of the lease, the district court inequitably found that the refusal to pay a $250 contractual penalty, which is unenforceable under controlling authority in Colorado anyway, was sufficient to justify the eviction of the tenant and the destruction of its business.
I want to talk a little bit about that $250 penalty, if I might, counsel. I apologize if I'm getting ahead of your presentation, but I want to get some of the facts straightened out on this case. As I understand, the $250 penalty was for late payment, or it had to do with the CAM charges, correct?
Yes, sir.
Right. Now, the CAM charges, if the CAM charges were not actually underpaid, then was the $250 penalty improperly assessed, in your view?
Well, yes, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. First of all, the CAM charges, these were extraordinary CAM charges. These were the CAM charges that were truing up the prepaid CAM charges for the last year and the new CAM charges for the ensuing fiscal year.
All right. So is it your understanding under the lease that the lease required there to be no overpayment of CAM charges?
Well, the lease could end up with overpayment of CAM charges, which would also be trued up at the same time with a credit against future CAM charges.
All right. So when you're talking about truing up, essentially, in the end, the tenant was not supposed to wind up overpaying CAM charges.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Now, I want to understand what proof there was in the trial court about the CAM charges. All I've seen in the briefs has been, and I might have missed it, but a reference to, I apologize, Mr. Spayo, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Mr. Spayo's affidavit that was submitted that said how the CAM charges, how the square footage of the space was to be measured. Was there any other proof that was submitted to the trial court about measurement of the space?
The only proof about the measurement of the space was submitted by Mr. Sprayo. He's the only person who actually measured. There was additional testimony by an expert who was an appraiser who had produced an appraisal several years ago, and in that appraisal, he had taken the county assessor's records for the size of that unit and incorporated in his appraisal, but he never measured himself. And there was also testimony that showed that a bathroom had been taken off of the per kill unit and attached to the neighboring unit, which accounts for the difference in the measurements between what Mr. Sprayo measured himself and what was in the appraisal from 1997.
So in addition to the affidavit, in terms of what was presented by the Zeke Coffee or Per Kill side of the case, Mr. Sprayo actually testified live in the courtroom about the measurements, is
yes,
that correct?
Sure.
Do you happen to know where in the record that is?
Your Honor, I'll be happy to find that for you.
That's okay, but I'll take your representation, counsel.
Yes, Your
Thank
Honor,
you.
It's in the record. The district court deprived the tenant of more than just the rights under the FED statute. The trial court also ordered the forfeiture of the tenant's unconditional option to extend the lease and rewrote an exclusive use clause establishing Kirk Hill as the sole coffee house in the neighborhood shopping center. Further, the court ignored a specific method for determining Kirk Hill's share of common area maintenance, or CAM, charges to permit the landlord to systematically overbill Kirk Hill for these charges. And then, after rewriting the lease to the landlord's after-the-fact specifications to deprive Kirk Hill of rights it had specifically negotiated and received, the district court also rewrote the law of damages in Colorado and held that any charge designated as a late charge in the lease is enforceable, even if it would otherwise be void as a penalty.
Mr. Carling, if I can interrupt you here, you just said a mouthful or a whole bunch of issues there.
Yes.
I take it to the first one I heard, which is the option. I think it's the first one on the exercise of the option. I'm a little unsure about what your position is here, and it may be coming out broader than I think you mean. As I understand it, you're saying there's a right to exercise the option.
Yes.
And I think your position is your colleague across the, or your opponent here was not able to just say, I think there's a default option over.
Yes.
Am I accurate that in your view, they could actually prove the default and then the option would be, they could reject the option if they prove the default, they just can't reject the option by alleging a default. Is that right?
Well, you know, I think it's two things, and this option has gotten a little bit conflated here somehow with the right to continued possession, in and of itself. The right to exercise an option, in our view, is a function of what does the lease say about the conditions are for the exercise of the option. And in our lease, the right to exercise the option is unconditional. The option language, all it says is there shall be a five-year option and the rent shall be so-and-so. Unconditional. Now, I think the confusion is, if there happens to be a default, exercising the option doesn't negate a real honest-to-God default, all it does is it extends the term of the lease, but the tenant still held to the requirements of the lease throughout the extended term, and if there were an event of default, then if the landlord could prove it and went through the FED process, which is how you terminate a lease in Colorado, they could terminate the lease and evict the tenant, whether or not the option had been exercised.
All right, so I want to make sure I understood what you just said. So you get to exercise the option, but if there's a default, they get to say, I think there was a default, they can prove it, they can bring an FED action, in which case the lease could terminate before that five-year option's up. Yeah. They just have to prove the default.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yeah, for example, exercising an option doesn't mean that a tenant never has to pay rent anymore. You know, you still have to pay your rent, you still have to carry insurance, you do what the lease requires.
Thank you.
Normally in contract law, if you breach a contract, you can't rely on the contract. And if you're saying that a breach by the tenant by not paying the penalty, if that's the penalty, or I think the other alleged breach was not repairing the public way, do they lose the option because of that? Even though no FED action is commenced or notice under the FED action given?
No, Your Honor, and I would refer the court. There are two cases that that bear on this very issue. One is Brown versus Hoffman, and the other is Jameson versus Foster. The citation for Brown versus Hoffman is 628 P. 2nd 617. Jameson versus Foster is 646 P. 2nd 955. Brown versus Hoffman holds that in certain cases where the right to exercise the option is conditioned on performance of covenants in the lease, then an option can in fact be forfeit. Okay. Now, that case doesn't apply here though, for several reasons. First and foremost, because in our case, the option is found to be unconditional. The district court acknowledged that the option is unconditional. Okay, in that case, the district court found that the option was tied to language in an addendum that said that this addendum is given in consideration of the faithful performance of all the covenants. Okay. Second, the default in question in this case is exactly as Your Honor points out. It has to do with the public right-of-way, which is not even governed by the lease. The district court clearly found that the public right-of-way is not governed by the lease. So the alleged default that was used to assert that the option cannot be exercised was not even a default under the lease because it has nothing to do with the lease property. Third, in our case, we exercised the option, and then the landlord asserted this default for failure to restore the public right-of-way. In Brown versus Hoffman, it happened the other way around. There was a notice given that additional taxes and money was due. The tenant actually acknowledged that money was due, but there was a dispute about how much, and the tenant refused to pay any of it. And that led the court, the trial court in Brown versus Hoffman, to find that there was a substantial and willful default. And we don't have anything like that in this case. Jameson controls here, and Jameson distinguishes Brown versus Hoffman by finding that there's no substantial breach and no condition to the exercise of the option. Those are the circumstances here. Further, the Jameson court found a waiver of the alleged event of default, which negates any argument that the option can't be exercised.
Thank you.
Okay. So let me turn briefly to the subsidiary issue, which is the attorney's fees, and this is the appeal number two. The second appeal relates to the correctness of the amount of attorney's fees, and as we noted in our brief, this entire appeal will be moot if you find in our favor on the primary appeal. The award of attorney's fees is derived from the prevailing party section of the FED statute. So if you reverse the eviction, then necessarily the award of attorney's fees also goes away as well.
Are they then awardable to your client?
Yes, Your Honor. And Your Honor, the key issue here is very straightforward. Controlling authority in Colorado provides that awards of fees and costs under the FED statute are limited to those incurred in the connection with the claims and counterclaims that bear on the possession, the right to possess the lease premises. And fees incurred in connection with the claims or counterclaims that are unrelated to the right to possess the property are not awardable under the FED statute under any circumstances. And the controlling authority cited in the brief is, it's just plain straightforward. In the hearing on the reasonableness of the fees, the landlord failed to provide any evidence of what portion of the fees were incurred in the possessory claims versus the non-possessory claims. And despite several attempts to elicit an allocation between the allowable claims and the unallowable claims, the only testimony that landlord's attorney provided was that $150 was incurred in connection with the penalty claim, which is the one underlying the eviction. And neither the landlord nor the district court made any effort whatsoever to allocate the considerable fees between the permissible, the allowable claims and the non-allowable claims, and that was clear error.
Down to 12 and a half minutes.
Let me just wrap up my preliminary presentation with this comment. We believe that the district court really didn't have jurisdiction over the FED claims because the court's jurisdiction was not properly invoked under the statute. Colorado Revised Statute Section 1340.109 says that jurisdiction is conferred over the courts in actions, quote, brought in the manner provided by this article, close quote. Here we have multiple violations of the statute, and really under no circumstances could it be argued that these claims were brought in the manner required by the statute.
Did you bring a motion to that effect?
Yes, Your Honor. We brought a 12b-5 motion, and that presented exactly that argument, and we also made a motion for reconsideration when that motion was denied. And those motions are discussed in the brief, Your Honor. And I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Casey Frank, 21475, appearing for the landlord, the Papa Salsa Partnership, who's the defendant here. If it pleases the court, there's nothing structurally wrong with this case. There's nothing jurisdictionally wrong. There's nothing constitutionally wrong. The tenant brought a declaratory judgment. He wanted to clear up all the rights, legal status, and relationship between the parties. The landlord wanted to do exactly the same thing. Within this framework, this normal framework, the trial court concluded that the tenant's demands for money, over $1 million, and continued tenancy were unsubstantiated. The trial court also concluded that eviction was justified on two grounds: failing to pay the $250 late fee, and the tenant status as a month-to-month tenant under counterclaims B, E, F, and H. It's worth noting that, with one exception about liquor liability, the court did not dismiss the several other counterclaims as invalid, just that they had been insured, so they were moot. They were not active. But it's important, I believe, to understand the equities in this case, that we had the landlord had a repeatedly non-compliant tenant that costed a lot of trouble and money.
Can I ask you, Mr. Frank, before we get into the equities, and I'll tell you just straight up what my concerns are with your argument, because when I was where you are, I always wanted the court to tell me that. I have some sympathy for your argument, as you probably could tell, about that you should be able to bring a counterclaim. I have a lot more trouble with your argument that you didn't have to give notice, a 3-day notice and an opportunity to comply. I mean, that the FED statute says those are required. And I don't think there's any dispute it didn't happen. We're talking about there was one notice that was given 16 months before, whatever, some months before the violation that led to the eviction. I don't see how you can make an FED claim without having filed or served that required notice.
Your Honor, as a matter of fact, I'm glad you asked.
I'm glad I did too.
That's a red herring. That's from a previous potential eviction based on one of the counterclaims that was not valid in this case. There was notice given. There was notice and right that you're given on July 9, 2010, during the middle of this litigation, and was admitted into evidence.
Where does that appear in the record, counsel? I don't recall seeing it referred to in your briefs.
Oh, it's there. Let's see. The notice with right to cure, 10-day right to cure, was admitted as Exhibit NN.
And which issue? That was on a different issue, right?
I'm sorry. Okay. Both the month-to-month tenancy have repeated advance notice with rights secure. And I'll tell you where those are. The $250 late fee, forget the July, the 2009. I agree. That has nothing to do with it. That helps us not at all. But in July 9, 2010, we wrote a letter demanding the $250 and saying that he would be evicted if he didn't comply.
That's July 9, 2010.
July 9, 2010. This case was filed in December 2009. The tenant declined to comply. At that point, we asked that the court refile a counterclaim to supplement, not amend, but supplement our answer. And we asked the court to simply relate back this claim, which had notice and right to cure, to the notice to quit that was filed on January 15, 2010.
Notice was posted on the premises?
No, it was filed and served out. It was e-filed. Here's the problem we have.
What did the statute require that it be posted?
It requires personal service or posting.
And neither occurred.
It did occur through the attorney of record.
But that's not personal service.
It is when there's an attorney of record under 5B.
No, that's not personal service, counsel. When you e-file something on counsel, that's not personal service.
Well, here's the problem we have. The tenant filed a complaint, which is a little less to stay.
I understand that, but I'm just trying to understand if there's a statutory requirement, how you complied with it. Apparently you didn't.
That's impossible because of the actions of the tenant. Because the tenant...
Well, wait a second. You can't post something on the premises? Why is that impossible?
We could have, but we served him through his attorney.
I understand, and you could have, and you should have.
I wish I had. But we served it on his attorney because the complaint had already been filed. Normally, when we file a complaint for FED, who has an attorney of record?
You had already filed your FED action?
Yes, we found our answer, which had the FED claims in it.
Yeah, Judge Roy anticipated my question, Mr. Frank. I'm confused on the notice, and I apologize if it's me. I'm confused on the notice and the, just the chronology of things on your complaint. So would you, I mean, as I read the statute, and service is an issue as well, but you got to give notice, you know, at least 3-day notice and an opportunity to cure before you file your FED action. The defaults here, as I understand it, were the failure to pay this $250 late fee and this alleged default about the failure to remediate the playset. All right. Did you give notice of those things in some sort of 3-day notice, and, you know, with a request for compliance or possession regarding those two things before the FED action was filed? Or your counterclaim was filed?
Before the counterclaim for the $250 late fee breach was filed, we gave notice on that. That's the July 9th notice. Right. Then when the 10 days went by and he said, no, we're not paying, we filed a motion to supplement the answer with a counterclaim, which contained the FED. So there was notice, right to cure period expired, then we filed that FED claim. And then we asked the judge to relate it back to the January 15th, 2010 notice to cure, which you have the right to cure it. Because you have the right to cure after the cure period. There's many times you have the right to cure. And one of them is if you've been offered the opportunity to cure and you declined, and then you're asked to leave.
And so before you filed your counterclaim, you gave notice, if I heard you right, on the $250.
Correct.
Did you also give notice about the playset remediation before
Correct.
You filed the counterclaim?
Twice. Okay. In 2008, and they can
both by posting.
No, those were all by through his attorney.
Now, counsel, let me ask you about this $250 late fee. If the underlying CAM charges were not underpaid. Just take that as a hypothetical
okay.
for right now, okay? If they were not underpaid, is it correct that no $250 late fee would be owed?
Correct. And I think as the court already noted that sometimes they were overpaid at the end of the year, there was a year-end adjustment. Sometimes it ended up, because you don't know the tenant.
But throughout the tenancy, he was charged on 820 square feet.
Yes, correct.
When there's only 755 or 775 square feet. Is that overcharge?
No, because the lease is not based on square footage. It simply has a monthly component. You pay.
Aren't the common area maintenance fees distributed and shared
yes.
on a square footage basis?
Yes, I can say.
Isn't that the CAM expenses?
If they were wrong, yes. If the square footage was wrong,
then he was overcharged throughout
yes.
his tenancy.
Yes.
We don't know yet to this day whether he was in fact owed anything.
Well. The trial court concluded, having heard all the testimony, including...
And with the trial court based that on the first paragraph of the lease that said approximately 820 square feet, when within the lease there was a very specific provision for measuring the square footage.
Well, how was it?
And that was done, and it was less. How do you get there from here?
You get that because the tenancy was started with 820 square feet accepted by both parties. 6 years later, for the first time, there was this claim made. And isn't it reasonable for the landlord to rely upon the tax assessor's numbers, which were used right along?
How do you modify the building?
There was no, I challenged the to show that there was evidence establishing that. It certainly was not established.
But my second answer to you, since you asked me the question, is probably not. I mean, it's what's actually leased that controls the common area maintenance. I don't know.
Well, let me ask you this. What evidence was there in the record to contradict Mr. Sprayer's testimony as to what the measurement was?
Just the tax assessor's numbers, adopted by the appraiser's numbers, adopted by the tenant in 2004.
But so you disagree, is it your position that the tax assessor's numbers were the actual correct measurement?
They were the operative numbers at all.
No, that's not my question, counsel.
I don't know.
Okay.
No, I don't know.
I mean, your argument, as I understood it on this, and what I think the district court accepted, was that the parties agreed to approximately 820, close enough for Jazz, I think is what the court said. I mean, not those words, but right? I mean, they thought it was approximate, and that's what the parties agreed on. I suppose, and maybe you can respond to this, as Judge Roy pointed out, there's, you know, the CAM section itself has this, you know, calculation for how you do the pro rata, and then there's a definition of floor area in section 2412 tells you how to measure it. If the parties intended 820 square feet to be the number, isn't that superfluous? Why do you need to know how to measure it if the parties agreed on 820 square feet?
Well, that comes out to approximately 820 square feet. And also, I will point out in the complaint adopts those 820 square feet. He admits that in the complaint.
But then, as I recall it, didn't they, there were various amendments, and then in a latter one, they denied it. I mean, they basically, they measured and they realized they were wrong.
That's correct, six years later.
All right.
I would like, if I may return to the issue of notice, and the fact that the tenant argues that a separate complaint, if we're talking about the literal minutia of the literal words in the statute, it requires a complaint. I would concede it requires a complaint. The provision about the complaint refers to the recovery of possession and the amount of rent due, which can only be brought by a landlord. It doesn't apply to any tenant, including this one. So it contemplates a landlord suing. But here we had a tenant sue, not, of course, for its own eviction, but it's sort of an anti-eviction, to prophylactically stop potential eviction. And the landlord is in a position, they couldn't bring a separate lawsuit, because this trial court, had exclusive jurisdiction. The principle of exclusive jurisdiction prohibits another court from taking charge of the same parties and the same transactions at issue in this court.
At least theoretically, it was possible to file a separate complaint and then move for consolidation, correct?
No, the second court did not have jurisdiction. Under a Martin B. District Court and Utilities Board with the Southwest at 375 P. Second 105 and 468 P. Second 36.
I'm sorry, counsel, I don't understand your argument. When you said you don't have jurisdiction, I mean, are you saying because it was the first filed court, you take it first? I'm very confused.
Well, only because the parties were the same and the subject matter was the same.
So you're basically saying it was a compulsory counterclaim.
You anticipated an argument. The landlord was compelled to file this counterclaim in that court because of Rule 13. Otherwise, they were precluded by issue preclusion from bringing it later because it was an issue that could have been litigated in the same proceedings.
But aren't there examples where you would have, there may be a, what would ordinarily be a compulsory counterclaim but couldn't be brought, say hypothetically, what would be a counterclaim was a copyright claim, which has to be brought in federal court, and you couldn't bring it here. I mean, I could think of a lot of examples where there would be that situation where you would have to file it in the federal court, and you wouldn't be barred because you couldn't bring it in that court.
Yes, that's true. I've seen a Supreme Court case where there was an issue between a tribal court and a state court.
Right.
And we're absolutely right. Here, that doesn't apply. We're talking about state court actions.
But the fact that it's a compulsory, I'm sorry, Judge, the fact that it's a compulsory counterclaim doesn't mean that the court didn't have jurisdiction, right? I mean, we're really talking about the same thing. You're really saying that it was a compulsory counterclaim, so you had to bring it there.
Right. Okay. That's correct.
I understand your argument.
Otherwise, you'd run into plain preclusion.
I can think of only one other statute that, offhand, where you affect somebody's interest in property by bringing an action or having a dispute. That's a mechanics lien statute. And it, like this one, says you do A, B, C, and D, or you're out. Okay? The FED statute seems to me says you do A, B, C, and D, and you're out. Now, I don't think you may have been precluded from bringing a counterclaim, but I think you have to serve personally under the statute, because the statute says it clearly that you must. And then you can bring it as a counterclaim in this declaratory judgment action, I would think. But the problem for me is you didn't give the requisite notice, and I realize it's a technicality. But if you read the mechanics lien statute, you'll see that you have to file a lest pendens on the same day you file your complaint or you lose.
So what if an owner sued the mechanic for an injunction against the mechanic's lien? That's equivalent of what we have here.
That happens all the time.
Prophylactically, they sue?
I've seen it.
And what happens?
You get a breach of contract case. Yeah, and they have to comply with the mechanic's lien statute.
Right. Well, there's also, besides the fact that the complaint calls for, it calls for personal service or posting, it also calls for the landlord to be the plaintiff, which is why the provision about the complaint talks about recovery of past due rent and recovery of possession, neither of which apply to a tenant.
Well, you could bring the FED action separately, I think, and merge and consolidate them. But I'm not even sure you can't do a counterclaim. I just think that you have to meet the statutory requirements before you can do so.
There's also the rule of professional conduct about communication with the party represented by an attorney. Normally,
posting a notice is not communication with a party represented by an attorney.
There's also the fact that they wrote us and said, do not ever contact our client directly. That's in my brief.
Meeting the statutory requirements would have not have violated any ethical requirement.
I guess I would ask, what exactly is it that they didn't have notice of? They were given notice of month-to-month tenancy in...
That's the problem with highly technical statutes. It doesn't make any difference whether they knew or not. They had to be told in accordance with a statutory form. Because you're seeking to throw them out of their house or out of their business. That's my problem.
So even though they had notice...
You could have called them on the telephone and read them the notice.
Not ethically, but...
But I mean, within the confines, speaking only within the confines of the statute, you could put them on actual notice, and if you don't post it, you don't have an FED action.
How does the court feel about the need for the plaintiff, defendant to comply with the literal language of the law where the tenant did not? Does it make any difference to the court?
It's not the court's call. It's the legislature's call.
I agree. The legislature...
Then we have to follow the statute, counsel.
All right. The legislature also provides for the quick docket in an FED. And yet the tenant moved to the court to postpone the eviction until all the other issues, the many issues, were complied with.
That's permitted in a proper case. That's in the court's discretion.
They stayed in possession for an extra year. Well, it's in the court's discretion.
Counsel, if you haven't given them notice, they're still in possession. They still have a right of possession, don't they?
No, because they had actual notice. And they themselves did not comply with the statute. This entire litigation became so convoluted that the court was forced to sort of combine things. I mean, under their reading, every time we file a counterclaim, we'd have to find him or troop out while he's no longer in possession. Well, because he was in possession at that point. We have to troop out and post notice. Even though he's represented by an attorney, I mean, that's formalism over the sake of function.
I'm not going to disagree with you on that, counsel. I really am not.
Okay. So the fact that they didn't comply is not germane.
Mr. Frank, can I ask you to turn to the actual defaults at issue here?
Yes.
And as I understand it, and we've already, I think, confirmed, there were really two of them. One was this failure to remediate the play set, and then the other was the $250 late charge or late fee or penalty. On the play set, an issue they've raised, I know, is that there couldn't be a default under the lease here for that because that place set was it was not on the property. What's your response to that? How could it be a default under the lease to not have remediated something not on the premises?
The lease covers the land adjacent to the landlord's land. This was adjacent to it. You have to read both parts of the court's order. One, it said...
Well, I've read it, I promise. Could you tell me in the lease what which section you're talking about?
Section 8.02. The Palace has exclusive right to make any improvements in the shopping center or on the lands adjacent. That was Exhibit A to our complaint, or our answer.
Well, there was some discussion in the lease negotiations or even in the lease about using that space, was there not? You had to coordinate with the city and landlord and owner.
No, that had to do with a patio directly abutting the premises leased by the tenant. This was public right-of-way adjacent to the landlord's property in front of another tenant that the tenant appropriated for its own use. The tenant, in fact, did have a patio, did have a right to use it, and the court's order makes that distinction.
Maybe you can help me out here. The section you're pointing me to says the landlord has the right to construct buildings or other improvements in the shopping center and or lands adjacent. Are you saying that the tenant breached that by basically taking land that the landowner could have developed? Is that the point?
Yeah, well, as you know, the landowner is responsible for the public right-of-way that abuts their property. That's pretty common knowledge. And yeah, they were responsible. That's why they had to remediate it. They were required.
This is part of the street right away.
The public right between the sidewalk and
the outdoor patio was also on the right away, was it?
No, it's actually on the property.
It's actually on the okay.
As it turns out, but the order, both I agree. It's somewhat ambiguous. The trial court's order both says for the purposes of the injunction, the tenant had no right to do anything in the right of way. He has no right under the lease. He has a right to have the patio, which is different. But the court also held, after hearing all the testimony, that the tenant had a requirement to remediate, to reimburse the landlord, which he refused to do right through to the end of judgment. And this is the distinction the court made. The counterclaims that might have been valid counterclaims were cured. Other counterclaims were cured. This one had not been cured. And you asked about notice in the right to cure. Exhibit N, September 3rd, 2008. It's admitted in the record. And Exhibit C, October 8th, 2008.
What are these that you're referring to, counsel?
The first one is the notice that the tenant had to reimburse the landlord for the damages that the tenant caused, which the landlord had to spend money to fix. And that's in the one from September 3rd, then October 8th.
Is that's the remediation of the place that you're talking about?
Yes, the ground where the place that had been. And then Exhibit C, the one from October 8th, 2008, which the trial court, which Judge Whitney refers to specifically in his order, is the one where we said, well, you refuse to remediate, your cure period is over, your lease is in breach fatally, and you are now...
N and C are notices to quit?
No. The notice to quit came later on January 15, 2010. When the breach was still current. That was part of the record here.
That was posted?
No,
it was same issue.
Right. You know, I do concede that this issue of can you end a lease by declaring it's ended is ambiguous. The landlord gave notice. There was a breach. Ultimately, the court said it was a valid breach, that the landlord is right. But at the time, it is inherently ambiguous. I think of it like common law marriage. You don't really know if you're common law married until you try to get a divorce, at which point the court has to first decide that you were married. But when they decide you're married in a divorce setting, they don't create newlyweds. They say, yeah, you're right, you were common law married since whenever. And what this court did was analogous to that. They said, yeah, back in 2008, there was a breach. You gave notice by letter to his lawyer, and he gave the right to cure. He didn't cure. Then fast forward to this lawsuit inside of which we filed a notice to quit and on January 15th.
As I understand Judge Whitney's order, the only breach that he relied on or found, actually, was the breach of the $250 late fee. Is that correct? Am I missing a breach somewhere?
I think you are, because in determining that, but I understand it's kind of ambiguous.
As I understand it, he said the landlord could reject the exercise of the option if the landlord thought the tenant was in breach, whether or not the tenant actually was in breach.
Well, the landlord couldn't go ahead and enforce it unless the tenant was in breach.
Okay, so what breaches did I miss?
What I think
that, is that the court found?
The breaches that made him a month-to-month tenant.
Well, that's what I'm asking. What breaches were they?
They failed to remediate the right-of-way.
But the court found that wasn't part of the lease, and so
his
it wasn't.
Use of it wasn't part of the lease, but his damages that he caused the landlord were.
All right. Well, what part of the trial court's order are you looking at that says that?
Tax my memory.
I'm asking because I didn't see it in there.
I think it's probably easier found it in our brief.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Why don't you look for that during the rebuttal, and okay. Then you can tell us
okay.
At that point.
Very good.
You can proceed with your argument if you have anything left to say.
Okay. All right, Your Honor. I still argue that they can't use the law as a sword and a shield. They can't use it to extract an extra year of tenancy out of the law, and I didn't finish, avoid the bond that the statute requires or calls for, doesn't require it. But the judge ordered that they post a bond, and they moved to get it vacated, and it was vacated, and we agreed to vacating it. But the point is they used the statute in an unorthodox manner to avoid the strictures posted on them, pressed upon them, but at the same time they're using it as a sword to.
You said they posted a bond under the FDD.
No, they didn't. They ordered to post a bond because the FDD statute requires if you get a delay of more than 5 days, you post a bond. The trial court ordered them to post a bond. They objected. We said that's fine. And they didn't, when the bond requirement was vacated. The point is it benefited them to deviate from the statute. When it benefited them, they deviated from the statute. And it's unfair to allow the literal meaning of the statute when it's brought in a topsy-turvy way, as the court noted, requiring us to make a counterclaim to hold that against the landlord. We have a minute left. Let me see.
Go ahead. Just
it may be, Mr. Frank, it helps Shani under the month. It's a heading called month-to-month provision, where the court at least cites sections 8.02 and 8.03.
Yes, Your Honor. I might as well just wrap up. That's it. It's on the month-to-month provision section of the court's order. Where the court adopted that the tenant was a month-to-month tenant, which means after 10 days notice at any time, the landlord could evict him. So whether that was the grounds in the trial or not, it's moot at this point because he's gone. Thank you, Your Honor.
I got a mouthful, Mr. Callahan, to address, but I would really like if you would address this issue of the timeliness of these notices. Let's put aside the issue of service. I understand your position on that, but just, you know, do you agree that notice was given an opportunity to cure on these couple of things before the counterclaim was filed?
No, Your Honor. No notices were ever given, and no statutory 3-day right to cure was ever given. And, Your Honor, if I could direct the court to section 17.01 of the lease, what this says is, and this is the default section, and I'm just going to read very briefly, the occurrence of any of the following shall, at landlord's option, be deemed a breach of this lease, any late payment due and payable to landlord under the basic lease provision, and such failure shall continue for 10 days after written notice from landlord to tenant of such failure. So, by the definition of the lease, a default cannot even exist until there's notice and a 10-day cure right. And after that, then the landlord can declare a default, but if he wants to evict the tenant, then he needs to go under the statute. And the statute requires a notice and a 3-day cure period. And none of that was ever done.
So what you're saying, if I'm understanding you, is that Exhibit N and Exhibit C that Mr. Frank referred to were the notices under this provision of the lease.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, but then never gave the second notice in your view that was required under the statute.
That's correct. So they never properly invoked the statute, and maybe they could have. And if they had, for example, believed that the failure to pay the $250 was a breach of the lease and they had sent the notice and given the 10 days, then they could have posted or personally served a 3-day demand for compliance or possession. That would have invoked the statute and would have permitted the court to assume jurisdiction over the FED and terminate the lease and evict the tenant. That never happened. I also wanted to go through the chronology of how all this happened. So Mr. Frank talked about a number of items that he referred to as notices. Those are all letters, and those were letters written to me. Some of them were written to my client's other counsel, and those were letters required by the lease under the provision that I just said. The so-called notice to quit, that was served in January 2010. That occurred over 2 years after most of these alleged defaults took place and were cured.
Well, the 250 was never cured.
The 250 was never cured, but that had not even occurred at the time that notice to quit was served. That happened in January 2010, and the failure to pay the $250 didn't happen until July, 6 months later. So that notice couldn't possibly have given notice. Now, Section 106 of the FED statute requires any notice under the statute to specify exactly the nature of the default. That was never complied with. There was never a notice served that said you failed to pay $250. We were watching for that. We wondered if they were going to invoke the court's jurisdiction by serving a notice on us and demanding compliance in order to invoke the court's jurisdiction. And if that had happened, maybe we would have paid the $250 under protest. I don't know, but that never happened. So, okay. As to whether an action can be brought separately, I think, you know, when I represent landlords, I don't care what else is going on. The statute tells me that there is a complaint required. I file a complaint. That's the safest course of action. That's what the statute requires. And if those cases need to be consolidated, they need to be consolidated, and the court can sort that out. But I think there's a real jurisdictional question if you deviate from the requirements of the statute, whether they're technical or not. And I wanted to address the suggestion that actual notice can serve in lieu of the specific service of notice under the statute, and that question has been addressed and rejected in Rocky Mountain Properties versus Purified H2O to Go Co. 3 Pacific 3rd 679. And in that case, The landlord did exactly the same thing. They attached their so-called three-day notice to the complaint that they filed. And the court held, I don't care if there's actual notice or something else. The statute requires that it be done this way. That notice, that service, and that form of notice is not valid under the statute.
Wasn't the issue in that case, though, that there was not advance notice, that the statute required 3 days advance notice?
Yes, Your Honor, because the notice was served simultaneously with the complaint, and the notice and the three-day right to cure are prerequisites to bringing a complaint. So that's the problem there. But that's exactly what happened here. That notice to quit was served simultaneously. Well, it wasn't even served. It was e-filed simultaneously with the answer and counterclaims in July of 2010. And so it didn't contain the mandatory three-day right to cure. It was just a notice to quit, which was the inappropriate notice in the circumstances of this case anyway. I wanted to briefly also respond to the suggestion that somehow the tenant subverted the process by misusing the statutory provisions. I would note that Section 111 of the FED statute requires the landlord to serve a summons with a return date at least 5 business days and no more than 10 calendar days after the service of the summons. And that was never done in this case. By the time we got to arguing about will the trial be consolidated on the issue of possession versus the other claims, the non-possessory claims, it was already April. The case had been pending for 4 months. And at that point, the landlord was telling us that they were going to renege on the agreement that we had, that we'd try everything together. And that's why we moved to have the trial be consolidated. The court did, in fact, order under Section 114 that the tenant post a bond during the extended period. But then the parties agreed that no bond was necessary because the tenant had been paying rent every single month. There was never a question. This has never been about payment of rent. And so no bond was necessary, but the statutory provision was complied with to the letter. We never asked for any deviation from the statute. We just asked that the provision that a bond could be waived was waived, and the landlord at that time agreed. I would be happy to address any other questions that the court has, and otherwise I have a very brief conclusion, and I don't believe I have anything further unless there are additional questions.
Chair, your conclusion.
All right. The district court's ruling is not only egregiously erroneous, but if it's allowed to stand, reverses decades of well-established landlord-tenant law and endorses the disregard of statutory law, Supreme and appellate court precedent, and procedural rules by the district courts in Colorado. This court should reverse the district court's eviction of Perk Hill and enter judgment in favor of Perk Hill that the lease was in full force and effect and the option was properly exercised as of the date of judgment, and enter judgment in favor of Perk Hill on the breach of lease claims on the issue of CAM charges and the exclusive use clause, and vacate the balance of the district court's order, including the award of attorney's fees. In addition, plaintiffs respectfully request this court to award attorney's fees under the FED statute and the lease to tenant, both for the fees incurred in the district court action as well as in this appeal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, I would like to, you may have a seat, but I would like to make a record with regard to the briefing in this case. There's an important part of the editing process in briefing that consists of taking any disparaging remarks that you have made about the other parties or about counsel and excising it from the briefs. Both parties engaged in this practice of making disparaging remarks about the parties on the other side and counsel on the other side. My colleagues and I have all remarked upon it. Such briefing is not only a violation of professional standards and civility standards, it's also poor advocacy It has no persuasive value whatsoever, simply a waste of the court's time. It does not belong in any briefs filed in any cases in the United States, and it should not happen again.
With that in mind, I thank both counsel for their briefs, their arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.